I'm Steve Miller reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump refined his gun control views Thursday, saying he wants only the most trained 20 to 40% of teachers to carry concealed weapons to thwart school massacres.
These are experts. These would be people that actually would want them. And it would be a small percentage, but it would be a lot of people. And once you do this, you will have a situation where all of a sudden this horrible plague will stop.
Trump said he will be strongly pushing comprehensive background checks of gun buyers, raising the age to buy assault-style rifles from 18 to 21, and ending the sale of bump stocks that increase the firepower of some weapons. His thoughts on gun control came a day after meeting at the White House with survivors of schoolhouse shooting rampages and relatives of victims. The UN envoy for Syria is decrying a recent upsurge in violence in the country, expressing concern that the eastern Ghouta region near Damascus could fall victim to widespread bloodshed like that of northern Aleppo more than a year ago.
In an increasing incremental militarization of the conflict in eastern Ghouta, where civilians are suffering.
Stéphane de Mistura says world powers are not doing enough to halt the violence over the rebel-held enclave east of the capital that is besieged by government forces. A U.S. airstrike against al-Shabaab militants in Somalia killed four members of the al-Qaeda-linked Islamist insurgency group. The strike, which took place Wednesday near the town of Jamame, was coordinated with the Somalia's government and the U.S. Africa Command said it did not assess any civilians had been killed in the airstrike. This is VOA News. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has been named as one of the worst performing leaders in terms of human rights by Amnesty International.
The deliberate, unlawful, and widespread killings of thousands of alleged drug offenders appeared to be systematic, planned, organized, and encouraged by the authorities.
Speaking at a news conference in Manila, the organization's Philippine Section Director, Jose Alonzo, also said that the actions may have constituted crimes against humanity. Kenya's High Court on Thursday began hearing arguments in a case that challenges parts of the penal code seen as targeting the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities. The National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission argues that sections of the code are in breach of the Constitution. The commission's executive director, Eric Katari.
Homosexuality, which we are challenging today, is consensual same-sex intimacy, which is criminalized in our law. And our argument is that it's unconstitutional, it encourages discrimination, and violates the rights of human beings in Kenya.
Many countries across Africa have laws against homosexuality. It is not immediately clear when a ruling in Kenya is expected. The United Nations Refugee Agency says protests by Congolese refugees in Rwanda have turned violent with several people injured and that police have fired into the air to disperse them. Jeff Custer has the details.
Tensions are high over cuts in food rations. UN official Daniela Ionita says refugees refuse to return to Gazebo camp in western Rwanda despite pleas from government officials. The demonstrations demanding better living conditions or relocation began Tuesday. Rwanda hosts over 17,000 refugees from Congo. Most are women and children. The World Food Program cut rations by 25% in January because of low funding, and further cuts are possible. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Three Egyptian policemen were able to catch a 5-year-old child as he fell from a third-floor apartment balcony in Assuet, saving the boy's life. The ministry said the child was unharmed, but one of the policemen was injured and was sent to a nearby hospital for treatment. The United States will compete for a gold medal in the men's curling after knocking out their Canadian opponents 5-3 in a tense semifinal showdown at the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics. The U.S. victory Thursday is a remarkable turnaround for a team that hasn't made the Olympic podium since the 2006 Turin Games when they won a bronze medal. Just as remarkable was the loss for Canada, which has won the gold medal in the men's curling event at the last three Winter Olympics. For additional stories as well as in-depth coverage, visit our website. I'm Steve Miller, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
It is Thursday, February 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump says only the most adept teachers should carry guns in schools. United Nations officials appeal for a truce in Syria's besieged East Ghouta.
So they're very confident that they can get away with what they're doing. Russia will veto any Security Council resolution that they don't like.
And the new hit film Black Panther offers African Americans a chance to connect with their roots. It's all ahead. On Thursday, U.S. President Donald Trump refined his gun control views. He said he wants only the most trained 20% of teachers to carry concealed weapons to stop school massacres. Trump said he will be strongly pushing comprehensive background checks of gun buyers, raising the age to buy assault-style rifles from 18 to 21, and ending the sale of bump stocks that increase the firepower of some weapons. Last week, a man armed with an AR-15 assault-style rifle gunned down 14 students and three adults at a high school in Parkland, Florida, setting off a storm of protests over school safety in the U.S. Trump also praised Wayne LaPierre and Chris Cox, two officials at the National Rifle Association, the country's top gun lobby that's opposing almost every restriction that gun opponents have advanced in the aftermath of last week's rampage. LaPierre defended his organization during a speech to the Conservative Political Action Conference, which is meeting just outside Washington.
Just a week ago, we were all horrified by another terrible tragedy at an American school. Each and every member of the National Rifle Association mourns the loss of the innocent and continues to keep their families and that community in our prayers. We share a goal of safe schools, safe neighborhoods, and a safe country. As usual, the opportunist wasted not one second to exploit tragedy for political gain. Saul Alinsky would have been proud. The breakback speed of calls for more gun control laws and the breathless national media eager to smear the NRA.
LaPierre also said security needs to be tightened at schools.
It's a bizarre fact that in this country, our jewelry stores all over this country are more important than our children. Our banks, our airports, our NBA games, our NFL games, our office buildings, our movie stars, our politicians, they're all more protected than our children at school. Does that make any sense to anybody?
On Wednesday, CNN staged a town hall event in Florida that included survivors of last week's shooting. Florida Senator Marco Rubio told the audience he does not support arming teachers and defended his acceptance of more than $3 million in political campaign donations from the NRA. Under questioning by students, parents, and teachers, Rubio also said tighter gun laws alone will not prevent future shootings, while he does support a minimum age for buying rifles and a ban on the bump stocks that can allow some weapons to shoot more bullets more quickly. A Washington Post ABC News poll released this week said 86% of respondents who identified themselves as Democrats said stricter gun control laws could have prevented the Florida shooting, while 67% who identified as Republicans said stricter laws could not have prevented the massacre. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, Sarah, it can be no surprise to you or to our listeners, I imagine, that social media has really been pretty roiled up lately in the wake of a number of news events. Of course, we also have the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee conference, going on in Washington now, the fallout from the shooting in Parkland, the continued process, I suppose, of the Russian collusion investigation and just other things. People really seem to be unhappy out there, and especially conservatives really seem to be unhappy. Now, this week, Twitter engineers launched a campaign to root out what they call Twitter accounts and bot accounts. These are basically people aren't really behind them. They're just kind of set up. They run on their own algorithms. They're not really, it looks like somebody's out there tweeting, but it really isn't. So they started this campaign and they're removing a lot of these fraudulent accounts. Now, it just so happens that a number of these fraudulent accounts are those that follow what you could call alt-right, I suppose, conservative activists, people like James O'Keefe. James O'Keefe this week on Wednesday, and he's continued today, he's been tweeting it out, for example, quote, "Looks like thousands of Twitter users committed the thought crime of tweeting about God, the American flag, guns, and were taken off the platform. Our undercover reporting into Twitter showed those terms indicate to engineers you are for sure a bot." Now, that's not true. But nonetheless, the hashtag Twitter lockout is trending. It's trending among a lot of, again, conservatives. Dan Bonino, who's a frequent Fox News commentator, "I woke up and saw I lost almost 100 or so followers. Adrian Cohen, first time, first time this has ever happened. Are conservatives being targeted like the IRS?" So a lot of people kind of upset. Now, Twitter says, look, we're not censoring anybody. This is apolitical. We're just simply trying to, one, reduce the number of bots that are out there and reduce how people post automated accounts. That can be, say, an account that you or I have, but you can set it up so that it just automatically retweets, you know, from various accounts. And what you end up getting is a really kind of distorted sense as to, you know, what people are individually are saying out there. Discussions can sometimes be hijacked. So they've tried to change. They're changing their algorithms for this. But again, the conservatives are not at all happy. And some of them have even taken the step to moving over to a brand new social media. It's called Gab. GAB.AI, excuse me. It is, you know, it's they say it's ad-free. You won't be charged for it. But there's some odd things about Gab. For example, its logo is the face of a frog. Now, that may not mean anything necessarily, but Pepe the Frog has kind of become a symbol in some ways, hijacked by the alt-right. Also, I just did a search for Gab real quick. This is what I'll end on. And Google tells me, well, people who searched for Gab also searched for Drudge Report, The Gateway Pundit, Breitbart News, and The Daily Stormer. So these are all highly conservative, in some cases, really far, far right conservative. So you get a sense as to what's going on. It seems some conservatives are saying they've had enough with Twitter. We'll see if it stands the test of time.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Amnesty International, in its latest report, says the politics of fear and hate are being normalized by some leaders. A deadly landslide has occurred in Indonesia. China denies contacts with separatist militants in Pakistan, and some of the missing Nigerian schoolgirls are rescued. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The World Health Organization considers cardiovascular disease to be the number one killer in the world. And among the top risk factors for heart disease is obesity. A recent study led by researchers from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Maryland suggests that losing weight may not be as important as the number of years a person was overweight or obese regarding their risk of heart disease. The researchers say the number of years someone spends overweight or obese can combine to form a distinctive risk factor for so-called silent heart damage. The study suggests that sustaining a healthy weight across one's life is important for keeping the heart healthy and reducing damage as people get older. The researchers point out that their study was only designed to illuminate possible relationships between long-term obesity and heart disease. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a controversial immigration bill poses a key test for French President Emmanuel Macron. In Syria, witnesses said Syrian and Russian warplanes are at it again Thursday, bombing the rebel-held Damascus suburbs in eastern Ghouta, besieged for 5 years, where hundreds have been killed and wounded since Sunday. The UN Security Council is expected to take up a draft resolution calling for a 30-day ceasefire to allow humanitarian aid in and the medical evacuation of hundreds of civilians. Secretary General Antonio Guterres is appalled by the carnage.
400,000 people that live in hell on earth. And so my appeal to all those involved is for an immediate suspension of all war activities in Eastern Ghouta, allowing for humanitarian aid to reach all those in need, allowing for the evacuation of an estimated 700 people that need urgent treatment that cannot be provided there, and creating also the possibility for the other civilians to be effectively treated in the site.
Anthony Billingsley, senior Middle East lecturer at the University of New South Wales in Australia, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty what he thinks is behind this assault.
Assad's sense that he's winning, and given the Russians' involvement in this appalling process, that the Russian commitment is strong. There is an element to which Putin has been very pragmatic over the Syrian conflict and Middle Eastern issues generally. But here he seems to be digging in with the Syrians. So they're very confident that they can get away with what they're doing. Russia will veto any Security Council resolution that they don't like. And without wanting to diminish the appalling nature of what the Syrian government is doing, the other side is also lobbing mortars and things into Damascus. For the Syrian government to allow rebels to continue to attack it from such a close area is something that they can't tolerate. And it seems that they've just gone for the all-or-nothing approach to just blast everybody out, perhaps trying to force civilians to try to escape if they can.
They're likening this to Aleppo, where they negotiated a rebel withdrawal. Is that likely what will happen in eastern Ghouta?
I suppose that's possible, but where are they going to withdraw to? I mean, they've now turned their attention to Idlib, which was where all the rebels from Aleppo were relocated. You know, you can't send these people to Idlib province. Where are they going to go?
Further north in Syria, Turkey warned Wednesday that pro-Damascus forces would face, quote, serious consequences for entering Syria's Afrin region to help Kurdish fighters repel a Turkish offensive. How serious a matter is this?
This is the most extraordinary turn of events, isn't it, where you have a foreign country invading another country and telling that country for its armed forces to keep out. That country, which the US and others has condemned, is talking about protecting Kurds who happen to be allies of the United States. Talk about a complicated mix of alliances and loyalties. I suspect that the Syrian government is happy enough to go after rebels, but when it comes to the very significant armed forces that Turkey can bring to bear and the much more complex relationship that exists between Turkey and the United States and others, for example, that they're probably going to make a show, but it's hard to imagine that they would take on the Turkish armed forces.
Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales. France's Emmanuel Macron faces one of the biggest tests to date in his young presidency, as his cabinet is examining controversial immigration legislation before parliamentary debate. A record 100,000 people asked for asylum in France last year, and like elsewhere in Europe, public opinion has soured against migrants. For VOA, Lisa Bryant in Paris takes a look at what it means for migrants and for the government.
A metro rumbles overhead as a small group of migrants stomp their feet to stay warm on a cold morning. They're standing in front of a northeastern Paris office that processes asylum applications.
I came to take a refugee. I want to live here. I want to save a place.
My husband, my government has make it problem with me.
46-year-old Abdelkader is an engineer from Jordan who crossed Egypt, Libya, the Mediterranean, and Italy before arriving here 3 weeks ago. His story is not completely clear, but he says he faces danger if he returns home.
No plan, only I want to take the paper. If the police catch me, make trouble with me. I need paper.
If French authorities find Abdelkader's story credible, he might benefit from proposed immigration legislation. It aims to speed up processing of asylum claims and make it easier for minors to get asylum status. But it would also toughen treatment for so-called economic migrants, sometimes doubling their time in detention centers and introducing jail sentences and fines for those crossing borders illegally to get here.
Calais n'est pas une porte d'entrée dérobée vers l'Angleterre. Et je veux être ici très clair.
French President Emmanuel Macron defends this mixed approach as firm and fair. He visited the port city of Calais last month, where a massive migrant squatter camp known as the Jungle was demolished in 2016. Macron vowed there would never be another jungle, although several hundred migrants are still camped out in Calais. A recent poll also shows most French believe there are too many immigrants here. But critics call the new legislation overly harsh. They include some members of Macron's own The Republic on the Move party, which includes politicians from the right and left. Some say it violates basic human rights. Louis Georgetin, who heads an umbrella association representing Black French, says deterring immigration also doesn't make economic sense.
The best people from Africa, from Europe, from all over the world go in many other places now. So I don't know why we're doing that. We're losing image, we're losing expertise, we're losing human resources, we're losing our own identity.
The group of asylum seekers does not seem aware of the fierce debate over their future. A man who identified himself as Shinwari from a part of Afghanistan with the same name says after failing to get asylum in Austria, he's trying France.
Do you hear about the President Macron has a new immigration law he's trying to get passed? Have you heard about that?
Yeah, we heard. Therefore, I came because everybody say he's a good man. We have hope here now.
A few minutes later, police arrived to get the men to move on. Their final destination remains up in the air. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Black Panther is a certified Hollywood blockbuster, raking in more than $200 million in North America during its opening weekend, setting several records. As VOA's Kane Faraba reports, the film's success comes as no surprise to the fans that pack theaters on the south side of Chicago to celebrate a film that marks a welcome departure from the Hollywood norm.
Nine-year-old Akilah Jaco has not yet watched Black Panther, but she already knows something about the movie.
It's a black superhero. There's a lot of people like us, and there's a lot of black children in the movie.
Jaco was among hundreds of students from the Betty Shabazz International Charter School that turned a showing of Black Panther at the Studio Movie Grill Theater on Chicago's South Side into a celebration of African culture and heritage.
We want to see this.
we support this. We encourage that more of this is accepted.
Tahira Cartman says it's long past due for such a film.
It's 2018. We've had a black president. We shouldn't be just still having slavery movies. You know, we've seen those stories. We need to see more positive stories.
This film is a major departure as far as the types of roles that black actors are given and the types of storylines that we see black characters in the midst of.
Professor Blair Davis focuses some of his classes at DePaul University and his own study on the impact of comic book characters on pop culture. He believes Black Panther will be remembered as more than just a superhero film.
The best films, I think, we remember because they say something bigger. They say something about who we are as people, and I think the cultural aspects of Black Panther are what are going to allow us to remember it in years to come. So I think that it will succeed on its own merits as an action film, but I think that thanks to the talent of Ryan Coogler, that this will have a lasting value as this sort of perhaps sea change in Hollywood.
And it's a vision of black people in power and of black people having control over their own destiny.
Carol Lee is one of the founders of the Betty Shabazz International Charter School.
We're an African-centric school.
She says while Black Panther is a fictional film, it reinforces what they teach.
It's tapped the spirit, and that's why people are coming out in such numbers, bringing their children, dressing in ways, cultural ways of affirming. Yes, we are very clear about who we are.
It's definitely affecting the way our children, you know, see themselves and affect who they want to be and who they look up to, who they aspire to be. All of that definitely matters.
For Akilah Jaco, even before she took her seat to see the film for the first time, Black Panther was already teaching her an important lesson.
You know, it says, like I said, like, anything's possible.
It is also possible Black Panther could become one of the highest-grossing films of all time. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nigeria's health, education, agriculture, and governance sectors will get an extra assist from the United States. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced $89 million in additional development assistance to Nigeria to continue its support for development goals outlined in a Development Objectives Assistance Agreement between the U.S. and Nigerian governments signed in 2015. Nearly half of the new funding, $44 million, will support HIV/AIDS control through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. The remainder will help Northeast Nigeria increase agricultural productivity, economic growth, and resilience through the U.S. government's Feed the Future initiative, strengthen education, support good governance, and improve water and sanitation infrastructure. The new funding brings the total U.S. government assistance provided under the five-year assistance agreement to $808.5 million. USAID collaborated with the Nigerian Ministry of Budget and National Planning, the Nigerian Ministries of Health, Agriculture, Power, and Education, and state-level government counterparts, among others, to structure the bilateral assistance agreement, which runs through 2020. In addition to the development assistance funding, the United States provides humanitarian assistance to people affected by the ongoing conflict and severe food insecurity in Nigeria and throughout the Lake Chad Basin. The U.S. government, led by USAID, has provided more than $526.7 million in humanitarian assistance since 2017 and continues to be the single largest bilateral humanitarian donor to the region. This new assistance underscores how important the relationship between Nigeria and the United States continues to be. USAID Nigeria Deputy Assistant Administrator Julie Conan said, "Our strong partnership with Nigeria and its institutions will help Nigeria's efforts to improve its health, education, agriculture, and governance systems where they are needed most throughout the country."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, more Nigerian schoolgirls have been reported missing after the Boko Haram extremist group attacked a school in the northeastern state of Yobe. People with knowledge of the incident said 91 students did not appear in class when teachers made the roll call on Tuesday. The disappearance has raised fears of another mass kidnapping by Boko Haram. The terror group took 276 girls from the school in the village of Chibok in April 2014. That kidnapping sparked worldwide anger and led to the formation of the Bring Back Our Girls movement. Nearly 4 years later, more than 100 of the Chibok girls are still missing. Fearing a repeat of the Chibok kidnappings, parents and guardians gathered Wednesday at the Government Girls Science Secondary School in the town of Dapchi, demanding information. An uncle of one missing student said, "Our girls have been missing for 2 days, and we don't know their whereabouts." A witness from the village of Gumsa said, "I saw girls crying and wailing in three Tata vehicles, and they were crying for help." Witnesses told Reuters Boko Haram militants arrived in Dapchi Monday evening in trucks, some armed with heavy guns. They said the militants immediately went to the school, firing their guns. The witnesses also said that Nigerian security forces launched a search and rescue mission shortly after. Nigerian police and the Regional Education Ministry have denied the kidnappings happened. The State Ministry of Education also denied the kidnappings. However, they closed the school for a week to permit students and their families to reunite. Boko Haram began its rebellion in 2009 and has had a very harmful effect on the communities in northeastern Nigeria. The group has taken thousands of women and young girls, as well as boys and men old enough to fight. In addition, more than 20,000 people have been killed and 2 million others, mostly from the Borno State area, have been forced to leave their homes. Another 200,000 Nigerians have taken refuge in neighboring states. The charity Doctors Without Borders says hundreds of thousands of people who have been forced to rural areas of Borno are now totally dependent on outside aid for survival.
News reports suggest that the Vatican and China could reach an agreement on the appointment of Chinese Catholic religious officials. The goal is to end the split between state-controlled Catholic churches and so-called underground churches that obey the Pope. The Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera reported earlier this week that a Chinese delegation would visit Rome next month. Among those in the delegation would be China's deputy foreign minister. However, some Catholics are concerned about such an agreement. They say a deal would normalize relations between the Vatican and China without dealing with the division between official and unofficial churches in China. Jonathan Liu is a priest with the Chinese Christian Fellowship based in San Francisco, California. He says the agreement will do more harm than good for the independence of Catholics in China. Liu said, if the Pope demands worshipers to unconditionally obey the agreement, there will be a great deal of conflict. Therefore, I don't think the unjustified agreement will bring unity. He described the agreement as spiritual torture to Chinese Catholics. And he said that it would be considered, in his words, a betrayal by members of the underground church movement. The Chinese government cut relations with the Vatican in 1951. Catholics can only legally attend state-controlled Catholic churches. Church leaders, such as bishops in the state-controlled churches, are appointed by the Chinese government rather than the Vatican. Underground churches, however, say they are loyal to the Pope. Anthony Lean is an expert on the Catholic Church in China. He estimated that the country's Catholic population decreased to 10.5 million in 2016. However, ties between the Vatican and the Chinese government have improved under Pope Francis. In January, the Vatican asked two underground bishops working in China to be replaced by two who were approved by China. Joseph Chen is a retired cardinal, a top church official. He has criticized the improving relations between the Vatican and the Chinese government. He wrote that the talks with Chinese officials would only give control of the Catholic Church in China to the government. Chen, who also is the former bishop of Hong Kong, said that talks between the sides had not been equal. He said he had heard reports that China refused to discuss Bishop James Su. Chen said Su had been in the hands of the Chinese government for more than 20 years. Accepting their refusal is like kneeling down to them from the outset, he said. However, supporters of the effort to improve ties do not agree. Francesco Sisi, a former Italian diplomat, is now a researcher at China Renmin University. He said a deal does not hurt the principles of the Holy See, the government of the Catholic Church in the Vatican. Instead, he said, the move could be a way to bridge what he called gaps between China and the rest of the world. He noted that the world's 230 cardinals, except Chen, and all bishops in China have agreed with the Pope's decision. Hans Stockton is director of the Center for International Studies at the University of St. Thomas in the U.S. state of Texas. He says the Catholic Church is weighing the good and the harm of making a deal with China. In negotiations, China is expected to seek formal diplomatic ties with the Vatican. However, Stockton notes that such a move would hurt Taiwan, which could lose the Vatican as an ally. China considers the self-ruling island a rebel province. Some Chinese have criticized the agreement on social media. They say China will be the winner in talks if the government gets to nominate candidates for bishop. I'm Mario Ritter.
The United States won its first Olympic medal in a men's luge singles event at the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics. Chris Masder won a silver medal last week, equaling the best finish ever for any member of the U.S. Olympic luge team. In the past, American Olympians won bronze and silver medals in women's singles and men's doubles luge. Over the years, German and Austrian teams have dominated the sport. When those teams lost, other European nations won. In the luge, competitors lie flat, feet first, on a small sled. They can travel around an icy track at speeds up to 140 kilometers an hour. The riders control the sled's speed by changing the position of their feet or by moving their shoulders. So why did Team USA luge win a medal at the Pyeongchang Olympics? Most credit must go to Chris Masder himself. The American said his win was a product of 16 years of preparation and intense training. His teammate and training partner, Taylor Morris, called him an animal whose years of hard work clearly paid off in the end. But another reason for Masder's success could have been 3D printer technology, which his team used to make its equipment. The term 3D is short for three-dimensional, meaning an object with length, width, and height. In 3D printing, 3D models are first created as files or documents on a computer. The printer then uses a substance like plastic or metal to create physical objects. The process involves making one layer of material at a time until the objects reach full form. The USA luge team worked with an American company called Stratasys on the design and manufacturing process for the sleds. First, the company made a scan, or image, of the body of every member of the luge team. Then, 3D printing technology was used to create tools for making molds in the shape of Olympians on top of a sled. The process of designing and tooling sled parts is highly complex and can take several weeks. Officials from USA Luge say 3D printing can greatly simplify the process, speeding up production of parts to within hours. Gordy Shear is the marketing director for USA Luge. He says 3D printing works well for making last-minute changes that require exactness. As we learn more about aerodynamics and optimizing our designs, it's nice to be able to have the ability to make those changes quickly, Shear said. The head of technical programs for USA Luge, John Owen, says the use of 3D printing has made the team more competitive. It helps the team continuously adjust designs and run them on the track much faster than traditional processes, he said. He added that the technology also provides a way to perfectly fit each rider to the sled while cutting production time and costs. Other sports represented at the 2018 Olympics have used 3D printing to improve their equipment. Snowboard maker Capita used 3D printers to build stronger sidewalls for its snowboards. The process, called Fuse 3D, connects a plastic sidewall to the wooden center of the board. The technology even won a Product of the Year award from an international sports organization. 3D printing company Materialize makes form-fitted insides for ski boots. It uses a scan of a person's foot to produce perfectly fit boot inserts within a matter of minutes. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In October of 1859, a group of anti-slavery extremists attacked the town of Harper's Ferry. Harper's Ferry was part of Virginia then. Today, it is located in West Virginia. The attackers were led by John Brown. They seized a gun factory and a federal supply center where military equipment was kept. They planned to use the guns and equipment to organize a rebel army of slaves. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell us what happened to John Brown after he seized Harper's Ferry.
The President of the United States in 1859 was James Buchanan. When Buchanan learned of the attack, he wanted immediate action. He sent a force of Marines to Harper's Ferry under the command of Army Colonel Robert E. Lee. John Brown had attacked with about 20 men. Several, including two of his sons, had been killed by local militia. He and his remaining men withdrew to a small brick building. The attack had failed. Not one slave had come to Harper's Ferry to help Brown. The few whom his men had freed had refused to fight when the shooting started. Brown could not understand the fear that kept the slaves from fighting for their freedom.
Brown and his men were trapped inside the brick building. They held a few hostages whom they hoped to exchange for their freedom. Colonel Lee wrote a message to John Brown demanding his surrender. He did not think Brown would surrender peaceably, so he planned to attack as soon as Brown rejected the message. He felt this was the surest way to save the lives of the hostages. As expected, Brown refused to surrender. He said he and his men had the right to go free. As soon as Brown spoke, the signal was given. The Marines attacked. They broke open a small hole in the door of the brick building. One by one, the Marines moved through the hole. They fought hand to hand against the men inside. After a brief fight, they won. John Brown's rebellion was crushed.
A few hours after Brown was captured, the governor of Virginia and three congressmen arrived in Harper's Ferry. They wanted to question Brown. Brown had been wounded in the final attack. He was weak from the loss of blood, but he welcomed the chance to explain his actions. The officials first asked where Brown got the money to organize his raid. Brown said he raised most of it himself. He refused to give the names of any of his supporters. Then the officials asked why Brown had come to Harper's Ferry. "We came to free the slaves," Brown said, "and only that." He continued, "I think that you are guilty of a great wrong against God and humanity. I believe anyone would be perfectly right to interfere with you so far as to free those you wickedly hold in slavery. I think I did right. You had better, all you people of the South, prepare yourselves for a settlement sooner than you are prepared for it. You may get rid of me very easily. I am nearly gone now. But this question is still to be settled, this Negro question, I mean. That is not yet ended."
The raid on Harper's Ferry increased the bitterness of the national dispute over slavery. Members of the Democratic Party called the raid a plot by the Republican Party. Republican leaders denied the charge. They said the raid was the work of one man, one madman, John Brown. Still, they said, he had acted for good reason, to end slavery in America. Southern newspapers condemned Brown. Some said his raid was an act of war. Some demanded that he be executed as a thief and murderer. Many Southerners said all of the North was responsible for the raid. They believed all Northerners wanted a slave rebellion in the South. And it was such a rebellion that Southerners feared more than anything else. New measures were approved throughout the South to prevent this. Military law was declared in some areas. Slave owners threatened to beat or hang any Negro who even looked rebellious.
The fear of a slave rebellion united the people of the South. For years, rich slave owners had talked of taking the Southern states out of the Union to save their way of life. But those who had no slaves opposed the idea of disunion. John Brown's raid changed that. After his attack on Harper's Ferry, the South spoke with one voice. All Southerners declared that they would fight to protect their homes from a Negro rebellion or from another attack by men like Brown. Feelings were especially high in Virginia, the state in which the raid took place. Virginians wanted Brown punished quickly to show what would happen to anyone who tried to lead a Negro rebellion. There was some question whether Brown should be tried in a federal court or a state court. Brown's raid took place within the borders of a state, but the property he seized belonged to the federal government. The governor of Virginia decided to try Brown in a state court. He believed a federal court trial would take too long. If Brown were not brought to trial quickly, he said, people might attack the jail and kill him.
Brown was being held in Charlestown, a few kilometers from Harper's Ferry. The court there named two lawyers to defend him. A doctor examined Brown. He reported that Brown's wounds were not serious enough to prevent the trial from starting. Brown lay in a bed in the courtroom throughout the trial. John Brown's lawyers tried to show that his family had a history of madness. They tried to prove that Brown, too, was mad. They asked the court to declare him innocent because of insanity. Brown protested. He said the lawyers were just trying to save his life. He did not want such a defense. The matter of insanity was dropped.
Brown's lawyers then argued that he was not guilty of the three crimes with which he was charged. First, they said, he could not be guilty of treason against Virginia because he was not a citizen of Virginia. Second, he could not be guilty of plotting a slave rebellion because he had never incited slaves against their owners. And third, he could not be guilty of murder, because he had killed only in self-defense. The trial lasted 5 days. The jury found John Brown guilty of all three charges.
The judge asked Brown if he wanted to make a statement before being sentenced. Brown did. He declared that he had not planned to start a slave rebellion. He said he only wanted to free some slaves and take them to Canada. Brown's statement was strong, but it was not true. He had, in fact, planned to organize an army of slaves to fight for their freedom. He acted in the belief that slaves throughout the South would rise up against their owners and join him. Brown's words did not move the judge. He said he could find no reason to question the jury's decision that Brown was guilty. He sentenced Brown to be hanged.
One of Brown's supporters attempted to find a way to free Brown from jail. Several plans were proposed. None were tried. Brown himself did not want to escape. He said he could do more to destroy slavery by hanging than by staying alive. John Brown was executed on December 2nd, 1859. His death created a wave of public emotion throughout the country. In the North, people mourned. One man wrote, "The events of the last month or two have done more to build Northern opposition to slavery than anything which has ever happened before, than all the anti-slavery pamphlets and books that have ever been written." In the South, people cheered, but their happiness at Brown's punishment was mixed with anger at those who honored him. As the nation prepared for a presidential election year, the South renewed its promise to defend slavery or leave the Union.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. From Washington, this is